Hello and welcome to the Cynic Weekly on the 16th of November 2023. I'm your host Barry Gallagher, and as always I'm joined with the elite panel, Christopher Samani. How the hell are you?
Terrific. Thursday night, Cynic Weekly time.
Underneath the lights.
Let's go.
And also joined by Alan Edgar. Alan, how are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I'm looking forward to this a wee change for international break.
Yes, and as Alan mentions, the international break there, I'm sure that lots of you have been enjoying the football earlier this evening. It's just finished. But tonight we're going to do something a wee bit different from normal. Previously we've done pods called the Celtic Roulette, where we have a bowl. Alan, could you do a audio gag for me?
There is a bowl. That is me ruffling said bowl.
Nope.
Good solid and metal bowl as well.
The hot ball. He's found the hot ball.
And the bowl is filled with various issues around Celtic. So it could be players, managers, a period in time. Don't actually know, because our leader, Christopher Gallagher, has prepared everything for us tonight. He apologises for his absence. And I think we'll just get straight into it. So what we'll do is we will all choose one each. We'll choose one at a time and then pass round, and then we'll discuss them. Okay. I think there was a comment I saw earlier on Twitter that this is, I think, the third edition. We did one on a weekly before, so maybe this is the fourth edition. Neil Lennon seems to come out every time. So I saw Gal assuring the guy on Twitter that Neil Lennon is not in it. Famous last words of Neil Lennon. So Samara, do you want to start?
I won't do the gag where I say it's Neil Lennon. I won't do it.
Do the Rod Stewart?
It's Nick. No. The 2020 Scottish Cup final.
Oh, for God's sake. Alan's billed this as nice and light-hearted, but 2020 Scottish Cup final.
Do you want a redraw here?
I think we'll maybe just get into it. So, obviously, Samani set the scene. It was during lockdown, wasn't it?
Yeah. So this completed the treble. Nobody was there. Conor Hazard was in goals. It went to a penalty shootout. Craig Gordon got annoyed. It was awful. I mean, it's one of those things where you look at it, it takes a split second to sink in what Scottish Cup final that was, and then it's just a non-event. Because watching it in the house and everything in and around that was just,
yeah.
I mean, how often are we passing this ball around? How long are we going to spend talking about this?
We'll do this quickly, this one, I would say.
The only different thing I would add into it was that, I mean, Barry, your memory's far better than mine, but it was probably the highest point of football for us at that point, because, I mean, it was quite clear that the wheels were coming off,
aye,
I think, at this point. So kind of completing last season's work. Granted, I mean, it was not a great game, and if we would have lost that, then Christ. But I remember when the winning penalty went in, I think Chris Iyer scored that.
That's right.
It was a pretty nice moment. It did feel like kind of, it's hard to escape the fact that we were a bit of a bin fire at the time. But it was still nice to do four consecutive trebles, even though obviously we knew that that run was over by that point. But it was quite nice. It was, I think, as well, yeah, we watched it in the house, but still good to pick up a trophy. It's not the same as being there, but I mean, if you're talking about that period of time, that was without doubt a high in what was a very low period for Celtic. So, yeah,
I think we'll wrap this up quickly. Right? I remember, as you say, Alan, the wheels were coming off, because obviously leading up to that point, we had the, I think some man you've billed it as the worst Glasgow derby of all time. Remember when they beat us at Celtic Park?
I still think that, yeah.
So we had that. We had the heavy defeats to Sparta Prague.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the wheels, I think that's the best way to describe it. The wheels are coming off. And even in the moment of the sort of high of it,
mm-hmm,
remember Neil Lennon got interviewed and he dedicated it to Desmond and Lowell. I'm like, oh, well, that's you taking the one nice thing that we could have had today.
But I think the kind of narrative around it was that it was, you were giving Neil Lennon the opportunity to finish his work, and sure did finish his work that season.
Yeah.
I mean, It was a great game for the neutral, right? That's what, you know, people who don't support Celtic might have said, you know. And essentially, it went back and forth, went to a penalty shootout, you know. But for me, it was almost, you're saying it was nice. I just felt pure relief.
Relief, that's it.
And even then, it felt incomplete, as is, you know, all the trophies that season, you know, have got that wee kind of asterisk next to them. So it didn't feel that way. And then, as you said, you dedicated to Desmond and Lowell. And then in the upcoming period, we conspired to lose a game at Ibrox without them having a shot in target.
That's right.
And then they went on a wee holiday. So,
jolly.
So what it really does is just bring up some difficult memories. I mean, obviously it was the Scottish Cup final from the previous season. That's, you know, right. So it was all very, it brings up, you know, memories of how strange a time that was, you know, and amongst that, absolutely everything else. I mean, it was nice to kind of win that, and it was the absolute high of that season. But it just makes you feel weird. And I'm not talking about the game. It just makes you feel weird for something that happened so recently. And, you know, we all lived through it. But it's so difficult to imagine it now, you know.
I think that it probably sums up that year and that time entirely, that the best moment, whether you describe it as nice or a relief or whatever you describe it as, that the best moment from that year ultimately was a game from the previous season. And that kind of highlighted our mindset and where we were at that time. We froze in time and we just never moved on. Until the end of that year, that hellish season was over. So, yeah, so I will take the high from it. I will take the positivity, because that warmth had to take you through to like in June, next season.
That's right. And as you say, Simon, I totally agree. That does feel weird, because even I think back of that home strip, and when it all came out, I'm sure we all bought it. We all had that discount code for that all fell through. That was the warning sign that season was going down the toilet.
I don't know, see when you see people wearing the lime green away top, what's your thoughts? See when I feel like Bennett.
Aye.
I kind of feel like, doing? Give it up, it's done. Mm-hmm. It was a great top, but it was completely shambolic. Maybe in 20 years' time it'll have a redemption. Like, but see people's when I see one. People wearing it, even if I see people wearing it, see when I see people playing fives in it, I kind of feel looking up to them having a word and saying, on public, mate. Come on, don't remind people.
It will be that in 20 years. I mean, if you think that period was bad, when we were wearing the people's Celtic top, I mean, we were deplorable. But now it's like, it's like a reminder of youth. So maybe it will be good in 20 years' time. Maybe 30, I don't know.
And I think just to sort of round off on this as well, like we often
That's
talk
it.
About...
Cut it short.
We often talk about going back and watching old games, and there's no way, I don't imagine anyone will go back and watch this in 10, 15 years. If you're watching, if they bring out like an anniversary of the quadruple treble, I think you'd be skipping past this bit.
It'll be a DVD still in 20 years' time.
Definitely. Right, we'll move on. Alan, do you want to go next?
Yes, certainly.
OAB is up.
We rifle around.
Coca-Cola Cup 1994.
And the next one is drinking at the football. Drinking at the football.
Yes, officer.
Yeah, I feel like this is aimed at me, because did we not talk about this last Thursday?
When
I might have suggested that I'd had taken a can into Celtic Park one time. I mean, I highly recommend it. It's a fight, it's a balancing act. I've done it both ways, where I think the Scottish Cup final last year probably, where I went too heavy into it, and to be honest, the game was a complete non-event. So I'm glad that when Scottish Cup Final 2020 was brought up, I thought, well, at least it's not Scottish Cup Final 2023. Because I did very little we say.
So that thing
first half hour, great. Last hour, not got a clue.
So that thing, like in school, if you'd done like only part of your homework, you'd be desperate to answer that part, because you knew that. And then when it gets to like question four, hand down. But yeah,
It goes hand in hand perfectly. And I think the crowning moment, I think, of that, in terms of an atmosphere for our generation at Celtic Park, is that midweek game against Rangers under the lights with no Rangers fans. Just the most incredible, unique atmosphere that I've ever experienced at Celtic Park. And the one thing I always felt, I remember talking before in the pub, and the amount of people that had finished work at like 2, 3 o'clock and went straight there. And it was just, everyone knew what the deal was, that this was a very, this was unlikely to happen again. And just this perfect storm of big game, kind of must win as well. But also, no Rangers fans, night game at Celtic Park, and at what, 8 o'clock, quarter to 8 kickoff. Everyone kind of knew this was an opportunity, and just absolutely nobody let it pass. And it created probably one of the most incredible atmospheres at Celtic Park.
I did.
So did I.
Well, me and Barry were probably the only two sober people. That's the drunkest Celtic support I've seen.
Thank you.
One of the best. Well done. Well done.
Even the main stand was mad.
Some cognac's been passed round.
I think, though, linking it back to the previous thing, that's the night we emerged from that season, I think. I think that's the night that we, not only did Ange kind of, people kind of hoped, but they believed after that night. And I think the support played a huge role in it. The atmosphere was absolutely electric, fueled by all sorts of alcohol. Another good game for drinking that season was the Ferencvaros. The afternoon game. I think that was changed due to COP 26 or something like
half
that.
Half two kickoff?
Half two kickoff. I think a few people decided to cash in on a wee half day for that one.
That's a real pros, isn't it?
Yeah.
Half two kickoff, lad, just cracked their knuckles like, right.
Out before and then straight out after it. So, aye, drinking all that, aye.
See, when first came out there, Alan, the first thing I thought about was obviously 1980, the cup final where it was clearly taken away from us, from all the people now who get a bit annoyed about certain banners and songs, etc. But do you think we'll ever see a situation where we are permitted to drink in stadiums in Scotland?
I think you will. I think I don't think it's a really tenable position to have different rules for different sports with largely in the same stadia, for example, or with the same kind of crowd. I just don't think long term that's the kind of disparity that people would accept. But with the big caveat, I just don't see it happening anytime soon. No. I don't see it happening, you know, certainly this government or even the next. I think they've got bigger priorities, and I think you think about the history of the way football fans have been treated, specifically by the government, you know, of the day. I think the idea that they would then go completely the other way and say, yeah, let's give more freedoms to the football fans that we have. We did criminalise and we continue to do. Also, I'm not even sure. I think a lot of clubs would benefit from it in Scotland. Celtic would benefit as well. I just don't think Celtic have the appetite to even take the argument. I think other clubs would see it as more of a benefit because they would be able to sell that stadium experience. They would be able to potentially keep, you know, if you've got a crowd at 8,000-9,000, for example, they'd be able to keep that crowd there for longer and make more money. Whereas Celtic Park, I think they do okay. They do great with stadium tours. I know they've got the Barnes Stadium now. I think they do fine. I don't think they would rely on it the same way, whereas I think clubs like, you know, your Dundee's, Aberdeen, any other team in the league really outside of the kind of top three would look at it and see it as a big commercial opportunity. So I think it will change. I think it's one of those things that inevitably will be corrected over time, but that time frame might be you know, quite a bit in the future.
I mean, I think the point about football fans being treated different is more of a bugbear than what they're looking to bring in. Because even if you drink in an English football stadium, you can't take it in. There's seats.
Down in the concourse.
And I'm not entirely sure a lot of the support are talking about being able to drink at the football matches as having a couple of watered down pints of whatever sponsored beer is in the concourse. People are yearning for the days where they were able to kind of walk on into the terracing with a carry out, which is never going to happen. No. That's not going to happen elsewhere. So I think it will happen. And I think it will be a non-event because it will be that. It will be a pint of whoever gets the contracts watered down crap for about £7.50. Then people will go, I'll try one. Oh, wait, that tastes as crap as it does in the pub. And then they'll,
even worse,
they'll rarely do it. That, you know, it will probably be a more expansive kind of experience or range in like the corporate parts of it. But just generally, I just think when it happens, people will shrug their shoulders.
I mean, I think maybe 2017, 2018, I was working down in Newcastle a lot, and people that I worked with always said, oh, go to a Newcastle game, you like your football and that. So I used to drive back up for, like, granted, the big Celtic games. If I were playing Dundee at home in a midweek, oh no, I can't make it, I'm too busy. Whereas I remember coming back up like, for the Bayern game, I drove up and then went back down the next morning. And so everybody in Watford, they were all saying, go to Newcastle game, we'll get tickets and that. So I was like, okay, okay, I'll go to Newcastle game. Thought, it's Premier League, you know, and Newcastle is one of the kind of heartier kind of clubs, northern club, the atmosphere will be decent. Newcastle, Burnley at home on a Tuesday night. And I thought, okay, well, it's, you know, at least you can get a pint of the game, you know, and I'll get a bit of dinner there as well. So got to the stadium. And it was a bottle, I think, a Coors Light, plastic bottle of Coors Light, 330ml or whatever it was. And do you know the thing that, and I thought, I'll just get a pie. So whatever the pie is, they don't do, it was nearly like the pies in the wee normal tray that we get. It was like just a pie and like a, it's probably the ones you get like against us kind of thing, like and just a packet. And you know, it's the biggest letdown I've ever had. I kind of thought, I mean, I was going out to watch Newcastle Burnley, so I was putting a lot of stock in these pints being decent. And when I left at half time, me and my dad, just like, I can't be bothered. This is rotten.
It's not like you.
Don't start. And so I think you're probably right, but I think it's still the principle.
It is, yes.
I also think as well, maybe for people who maybe aren't thinking, you know, I want to get steaming, I want to have 8-9 pints. Maybe people that just actually quite enjoy the social element of it and can maybe hang about for half an hour after or whatever. And it's about, I think one of the big things about football and being able to do it is, see, like in terms of you thinking of the match, the atmosphere at Celtic Park, a big game, 20-8 outside, stadium is going to be absolutely rammed. See if you open the stadium up at 6:30, which they do, I think, just now.
Yeah.
But who in their right mind, really, unless it's for access issues, is going in at 6:30? See if you open up the concourses, people can stand there and watch the early kickoff on the, you know, like every
reruns
other
of old games or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you can stand there, you have two beers, and it means that you're no, you know, kind of waiting around or that. The amount of people that wait outside the stadium, bring them in, make a bit of money, give them the option. I think that's what it's about. It's about, like we were talking about the other week, try to improve that experience a little bit of going to a game other than just getting shepherded in and shepherded right back out.
I think that's the point because, as you say, Samani, it probably will be overpriced for what you're getting, but just that, even after the game, so even just to sort of have a wee debrief, couple of pints and then head home, let the traffic die down or whatever. And the thing that always sort of rails me...
Don't drink drive, Barry.
On public transport. The thing that always rails me is like, see when there's been events at Celtic Park, like I think there was that rugby... Sevens, was it? Rugby?
Yeah. Commonwealth Games as
well.
That's
right, we were able to sell alcohol then, but not when we were there. So it's hopefully something that will change, but certainly not in the current climate, I don't think, particularly with the Celtic board and the fans. Right, go for the third one. Let's see what we have. Right, ball playing centre-back. Shout out to K-Dev.
He'll be very interested in this section.
So when I think of ball playing centre halves, I think of first one that jumps out is Virgil van Dijk for me. And probably before that, Alan Stubbs to an extent as well. Yeah. Players comfortable can take it, tight situations, ping those wonderful passes, maybe sort of bring you out of defence by going by a couple of players as well. Christopher Ayer as well is another name that jumps out, but it's often the sort of, I think it's the sort of hardest position to recruit for, potentially in modern football just now, maybe left back as well. But what does it mean to you, Alan, when you think of a ball playing centre half?
Yeah, I think those names are the key ones. The first one that came to mind was Alan Stubbs, but funnily enough, I think Alan Stubbs was better for, he was just great at that. See that ball side to side, switching it over. He was just perfect at that, and sorry, I have an issue with my mic here. That big raking pass from side to side, he was great at that, and he looked like when he stepped out, he looked like he wanted to kind of get rid of the ball, but things seemed to open up. And Chris Ayer's kind of similar, that when he steps in, initially that first 3-4 steps he looks uncomfortable, but then when he steps in, actually it's almost like they build up momentum. So I think it's huge now. I think all the players that we have, they're all capable with the ball. They're all capable, certainly domestically. I think what you see, though, is in bigger games in Europe, is when they have that extra touch and you see teams tempting them out.
Yeah.
And we've probably all done it at one point where you can kind of, you almost see it happening, where you think they've taken an extra touch and they're starting to believe, oh, I can do something here. And you think, no, back you go. And I think that's the issue now, that I think everyone's comfortable in the ball. So it's almost about trying to lull players into make mistakes. And I think the really, really good ones are able to kind of navigate that line.
And they know when to go and when not to go.
Yeah, exactly. Because look, I think Starfelt, who is a centre-half that I think we all liked, I thought was really, really good and get better and better, actually, after a really rocky start at us. He was a player that I think teams would always try and attract into taking a touch, taking another touch, because then if he steps in, if the lanes, those passing lanes get shut off, he get uncomfortable quickly. Aye. I think the good ones, when those passing lanes get shut off, have the ability to then, you know, maybe take a player on or do it the right way or get themselves out of trouble, whereas the ones that are a little bit less comfortable, those are the ones that you see 10, 15, 20 yards ahead of the line making a mistake, because it's very, very difficult to recover from that then, because all professional football players, everybody can take a touch, everybody can pass the ball, it's about doing it in traffic and doing it when it matters really, and when you're getting pressed, when it's difficult, when you've got players either side of you. Centre-halves always like everything in front of them. If they were, see, not to be mean, but see, if they were really good in the ball, they would be playing probably 10, 15 yards up in centre midfield where the best players play. But when you've got guys behind, when you've got guys in front and the side, as a centre-half, I think it makes you naturally a wee bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, but similarly, and I've said it many a time, similar to a goalkeeper as well, that you can play football, their principal job is to defend, and a goalkeeper's job is to stop the ball going in the net. Because if that wasn't the case, then you would just put a midfielder at the back, you know, because they're comfortable. And that's the problem. And that's why ball-playing centre-halves and ball-playing goalkeepers are at a premium, because you need to be very good at both of those things. You know, we've seen guys, we've had attempts, like Doris de Vries was an attempt, somebody who can play football, very bad at stopping the ball getting in the net. Barkas, I'm not allowed to mention him, but I'm going to do it.
That's a book. That's a Barry, get his name in a book.
Very much, very much, well, look at the goalkeepers, you know, situation 2020 season, and then, anyway, I'm not going to bring that up anymore. Point being here is that I think we would all like a goalkeeper. I mean, I think everybody here agrees Joe Hart's probably kind of coming to his end of his time at Celtic, and you'd love a goalkeeper who can, you know, start attacks, build from the back and do that. But there's still a balance to be had in terms of the day job, if you will, and keeping the ball out the net. That's the exact same with a centre-half. And I think you're right. The centre-halves that we've got are capable, but they're not as capable as, you know, the elite centre-halves that we're talking about, who can really do, I think you summed it up quite well, in certain situations can get themselves out of that bother, can do that extra thing that's then going to start the attack. But that then becomes really difficult. I mean, Virgil van Dijk's a great example. We got him. We were lucky to find a guy like that, but that's luck. You know, you try and sign somebody in that mould, you know, nine times out of ten, they're not going to be at that level. You're not going to be able to do
that. There's other flaws in their game.
So when I hear ball playing centre-half, it's an aspiration, and I think that you should always be aiming for it. But I think when you focus on it too much, then it can be quite easy that you can... you then forget about what they're supposed to be doing in the first place.
I think the other thing as well is when you see, it comes back to a lot of our kind of issues that we talk about a lot as Celtic fans, but for the first, what, eight games, if we qualify automatically, you think, he's a pretty good defender. He's not looked like he's had any trouble domestically, and he's really good in the ball. And you think, presumably he'll be fine defensively, and then you see that first European game, and you see a ball sail right over the top, and you think, he is really good with the ball, but he is also really, really weak defensively. There's quite a lot you could count like that. The earliest kind of hybrid that I can remember of being in that scenario of really good up to a point, I think that is a great example of it, is Gary Caldwell. He was both decent defensively and decent with the ball up to a point, and then it became,
liability.
Yeah, exactly. Like
that bouncing ball in Benfica.
Bouncing ball home against Barcelona. And I remember, I think he got a pass from a lot of people at the time, because, well, he never knew that Thierry Henry was going to pick up the ball and cull it in from 25 yards. It was a fucking, felt like a good idea as soon as the pass was made.
Never done that before.
The thing with Caldwell, though, is that you then sprinkled a hefty dose of ego over the top of that, you know, because there are certain players who are supremely confident in their abilities, regardless of what level that ability is at, you know?
Yeah. And I think the other, just to kind of round off on this, is you speak about, like, the higher up you go, that's why you pay a premium for them. But it's also a sort of double-edged sword, because if in the odd occasion they do get into trouble, they'll get better players around them in midfield to come and take the ball off them as well. So Hopefully we can unearth another Virgil van Dijk. Watch this space.
John Park will be screaming at his phone or his whatever he's listening to this on, because I seen he was, I think there was an interview with him earlier in the week actually, when he was basically saying that Celtic were ahead of the curve. He was kind of defending Celtic's early use of data analysis with guys who are still at the club, saying we were ahead of the curve and you can still do it now. So it was almost like a, I don't know if you get come and get me please for guys like that, but he is very much still saying I can still do what I did for you then.
That point reminds me of, see, when there was for years when we still trained at Barrowfield, mm-hmm. and people say, well, it was good enough for the Lions. There has to be a cut off point where you need to move forward.
I'll pick the second one here.
Is it no matter?
No, you just picked Ball playing centre half.
No, that was me.
Oh, sorry. Right, there you go. A fucking spoiled child, isn't he? Thanks very much. What were you picking? I hope it's Neil Lennon.
The old firm.
Do you know that's exactly what you deserve? Imagine using that expression on a Celtic podcast.
Guy's done you there.
I mean, maybe this is controversial, but it doesn't really bother me, the term, as much as it bothers other Celtic fans. I don't go Glasgow Derby. I don't actually use it because, you know, that's the done thing. But when I hear it, I don't bristle, and it's now became a thing. Yeah. Obviously, when you've been to Ibrox and you've seen the signs, and then we've seen the photos afterwards where they were all up next to the bins sort of thing. So it's became more of a thing. But if I'm being honest, it's not. Like, if somebody said that, I wouldn't go, what's that? Or anything like that. Whereas I think you might, Barry. I'm just going to point the finger at you.
I'm probably somewhere in the middle. And just see when you said that about people like sort of bristling, I went to see, it was a sort of audience of Martin O'Neill, and he mentioned the term. I can't even say it myself. And someone shouted Glasgow Derby, and I was like, but at the time when O'Neill was there, it was the old firm.
Yeah.
There's me. I did it, Alan's flying solo here. But, yeah.
We're almost conditioned, right? I don't really mind it. And then you go, what did you just say there?
Who are we talking about?
But yeah, it has become a thing. And I suppose the point where it died was when the previous club died as well. Alan, what's your sort of take on it?
Do you know, I would enjoy it up to a point where I'm probably similar to you both in that. I've probably not got enough time, energy to make the, oh, I don't know what game you're referring to joke. I wouldn't use it now, but it's mainly just because you don't use that expression anymore. Like, you know, it's just, I would say Glasgow Derby, but to be honest, I would...
Just blame them?
Yeah, I think it's probably, if I was sitting here and you were on a panel with a Rangers fan, now, as hellish as that sounds, then I would absolutely pick up on it just to be, just to be a prick, really. But... I couldn't really care less. Like, I think we're all well familiar with, you know, the history of what happened 2012 and onwards, but nah, I probably don't pick people up on that.
See, in terms of, to just sort of bring it round a wee bit then, so see that particular fixture, what's your first memory? So my first one would have been, first one I can remember was the one, I think we drew one each at Ibrox, it would have been New Year, and it was the one where Paul Byrne, ball from Collins, Burn had it with outside his foot. I remember Colin Scott and that blonde goal that they had. He was in goals for Rangers that night. Yeah. So that's my first memory of the Glasgow Derby. So, Manny, you maybe a wee bit before that.
Nope. Yeah, I remember. Well, the first one I remember probably the 1989 Scottish Cup final, actually, that I remember. Now, obviously, I've seen highlights and things like that since, but I remember it happening, you know, so that's probably the first one that sticks in my mind. And there's certainly, you know, a few after that. I can't really refer to it with that term now. We've obviously kind of self-censored here when we're talking about it, but that probably is. I'd maybe think about it a bit more, but the one that I'm clear on that I can remember would probably be then, actually.
I'll not be you.
I think just there, shout out to Brian McManus. So the first one that he remembered was the first game Celtic ever played against Rangers.
Where Neil McCallum scored. Sorry, private joke, my pal slagged me for knowing that.
I think first would be, do you know, one of the first game I remember in full, like proper game, would have been, I think, the 3-each game. What year would that have been? Is that
95? 95,
November 95.
I remember that, and But I think the earliest, I think probably a New Year game, because I remember going from, my granddad had Sky, so he was the one, basically you had to go there to watch the game. That was the...
Can't hide money.
Exactly. So you'd head up there, watch the game, and if you weren't there, you didn't see it. And we were somewhere else, and we headed over to my granddad's, and I remember, must have been in the door at 2 minutes, and Phil O'Donnell hit a shot, and he cracked a post.
Remember that one?
Now, I always think, see, when you're a wee guy, the pitch looks, but everything looks bigger. Even on TV, it looked like Phil O'Donnell hit the shot from 70 yards out. But I just remember it, and it was around that time when obviously we could do everything.
Let's go.
But beat Rangers at that time. So, but I don't remember, was that game before or after the 3-each game?
It was after, so I think that was the very next one, actually. I'm sure that was the game, it was 0-0, but we battered them, and I'm almost certain that was the game that Tommy Burns came out and made the comment about Andy Gorham.
I hate that quote. I don't even.
Andy Gorham broke his heart.
Had to say it.
But yeah, it's true, because around that time we were just...
Yeah.
It was always the same thing. They would either score just before half-time or right at the very end, and then the game's done for you.
I mean, I remember, was actually thinking about this recently, in terms of, it seemed like forever between wins, you know. But I think it was 94 to 90. Was it 90? When did Mackay and DiCanio score? Was that 97?
It was, so it was, yeah.
So it was Ibrox at 94 when McStay and Collins scored until then. That's how long we went without beating them, I think.
Fucking hell.
No, I think, I'm sure, remember the game at the end of the season at Hampden? It was the dead rubber and Rudy Vata scored the free kick. So I'm sure that was after that. But I think what you're thinking of, we went from 94 at Ibrox until O'Neill.
Until Lubo.
Yeah, Larson's 50. So that was that. That was 7 years.
7 years, right, yeah. Okay. So you're right, because we did beat the 3-0, Divata,
own goal,
Moore, own goal,
and Pierre
Van Hooijdonk. Thank you, Barry.
No worries.
It's good. Walking encyclopedia.
Something else, isn't it?
Yeah, but then, as you say, like, obviously that Hampden season, we'll maybe do a pod about that in the future. We often talk about that after a few drinks, don't we? But that game you mentioned there about the Malky Mackay and DiCanio, that was the first one I saw in the flesh of us beating them.
Scottish Cup game.
That's right. Quarter final, I think. Maybe we'll just to kind of round this bit off, but what was the first one, your first win against them, can you remember?
Oh, my first win. I'm glad you... first win was the 6-2 game.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, 6-2 game, and I think my first ever one was 3-0 when Rangers won the league at Celtic Park.
Oh, Jesus. I know. You deserved that 6-2 then?
Aye, it felt... That's why I think the 6-2, I got asked the other day, what was your key, your kind of favourite like memory of against Celtic against Rangers, and I just think it'll be hard to top that. I mean,
that first 8 minutes, was it? 11? 8 minutes?
Yeah, first 11 minutes, 3-0 up. I'd just be hard to beat that. I reckon Brendan Rodgers could bring me on in the last 5 minutes and let me score a hat-trick, and it'd still be hard to beat 6-2 against Rangers. Just incredible. Sunshine, and even the players involved, the goals, just iconic. I could comfortably still watch it back.
Mentioned earlier, just on that point, about we would never go back and watch that 2020 Cup final, but the 6-2 game, I couldn't tell you how many times I've watched it back, because it's your sort of go-to.
And you could probably recite a fair amount of the commentary as well.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it, because the commentary for it is just iconic, even to, I think, Larson's header when Ian Crocker's voice goes really, really... David Provan's voice, It almost sounds like he's pleading, because he's complaining that Barry Ferguson's 3 yards off.
That's right.
Henrik Larsson, and his voice goes so high, and you kind of feel like going, David, you used to play for Celtic, why are you bothered?
See, just on that, before I come at you, Sir Manny, see, if you listen back to old games and you hear Ian Crocker's voice, it's completely different to how it is now. It reminds me of, like, see, the first series of Sopranos, when Tony sounds different from all the other ones. What about you, Sir Manny? Can you remember your first in the flesh victory against them?
No. I knew you were coming to me. It would have been in the... It would have been in the early 90s. I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe.
I remember another podcast where they said, what's your first game? I've not got a clue.
Yeah.
I do not know.
That
and neither does my dad. I remember saying, what was the first game I went to? No idea. And it would have been... It would either have been...
Stop bothering me.
It would have... You know, some people are like, I'm taking my son to his first game. Right? I get taken out of necessity. Right? Yeah. So it was like, my dad either didn't go to the football or I went. At times, so his best guess was the season before the centenary season, which I would have no memory of.
It's narrowed it down to a year.
Or the or the centenary season, he's not sure.
So there's no.
So it was a special moment for me.
So there's no video of you coming up the stairs at the old jungle, wide-eyed, taking in the scenery?
No. So it's almost just like I just went. I'm going to need to think about it. I'll maybe come back because I can't actually think. Anyway.
What I quite like is pretty much most of kind of folk our era, and it seems to have continued on now. People's first game tends to be like testimonials, or like for a lot of people I know, like that took their kids, they took their kids to the women's game at Celtic Park at the end of last year. It always feels like that everyone, parents must just think, we'll do a wee kind of dry run at a game. Because I think one of mine might have been like Peter Grant's testimonial, like 95. I remember going to the, I think we played Hamburg in 94, 95. Yeah. So it would have been about that era. So I think a testimonial might have been a shout, but I always like it that people, it's almost like we need to go and see what they act like first, maybe they can leave, and then if it goes well, then we'll take them to a big game.
Yeah, that's it. Right. Is that me?
No, he picked...
I picked the Old Firm.
Oh, I tried to pick, remember?
Cut no, that. But remember, did you not pick?
Oh, sorry.
Because you picked...
I'm trying to pick again.
Aye.
I just love picking.
Right, okay, so this one is the Shadow of Larson.
What does that mean?
Shadow of Larson?
Does it mean, so trying to emulate him or trying to recover from him going, other than Larson's shadow itself?
I hope the suggestion here isn't that we're going to discuss the many diddies that would wear the number 7 shirt in the years following Henrik, because
well, we
I don't know how much time if we've got. Who would be the pick of the litter? I think Nadir Chiefji getting number 7 is probably a fairly low point for me.
Oh.
Even my watch is getting involved now.
So, it's in fact, you've opened a can of worms. Number 7 since then. Miku was a 7, wasn't he?
He was.
He was actually on the kind of scale, not bad compared to...
He was on the park against Barcelona.
Yeah, that's right.
It's fit and healthy.
Anyway, also for Juninho, who, when he signed, I thought, we finally replaced, replaced Lubo. And then...
Martin, he was the most un-Martin O'Neill signing of all time.
Yeah.
Juninho, and... he scored once for us against Hearts, didn't he? And then he was really good against Rangers.
Yeah.
His debut, that. Yeah.
Brazilian Roy Keane, basically.
That's it. And then it makes you wonder, obviously we were linked with Rivaldo that summer as well. Would O'Neill have used him correctly? I don't know. I think we were very rigid as we're coming to the end of O'Neill's sort of tenure. Other number 7s, Freddie Lundberg.
Patrick Roberts.
Lewis Palmer.
Palmer.
The signs are good for
him. He's a winger though, so we don't need to saddle him with a, you need to be anywhere near as good as Larson. I think long enough has passed now and we've had enough.
We've tainted enough that it doesn't matter.
Scott McDonald's is on about.
We've sullied the jersey to the extent that actually it is fine. And I know it's not a done thing in, obviously, football to retire a jersey. I think there's a couple of precedents for it, but obviously it's the done thing over in America. We, you know, but they've got up to number 99 that they can give out to players. They do it in basketball as well. I think if you were ever going to do it, it would have been for Henrik, but if you didn't do it for guys like Jimmy Johnson, then it's probably a wee bit unreasonable to do it for Henrik. So, aye. I mean, I wish we'd have retired some of the players that we brought in that we've mentioned there.
Yeah. I just think of that. See that meme from the Godfather, look how they massacred my boy. Just a reel of all those number 7s.
There's another striker that, was it the Skepovic get 7? No,
I don't think so.
There's another one I'm thinking that was in
I think
that
Chiefji's
era.
By far.
Aye. I mean, we'd seen him be bang average for other teams in the league, so it was quite a...
Aye, and then we signed him and he had that 6-match ban, remember, before he could play, so the less said about that, the better.
Peak Celtic. John Park's thinking if he's nut again, saying I had a guy.
I just get the feeling that when Gal listens to this back, he'll be like, why did you pass on that? But he'll need to explain to us later what he means by the shadow of Larson
means.
I think I might know what he means.
Oh.
I think he means, like, the fact that we're always saying who's going to be the one who sort of takes the mantle.
Or the best since.
Best since Larson, or Larson-esque and all that kind of pattern.
Hugo, the best since Larson. Yeah, maybe.
Or was it Dembele and stuff like that? Yeah, that's probably, that makes sense now that you say it. It's perfectly obvious.
now that we've slaughtered them.
Well, theoretically, though, you're going to keep saying that until you get somebody better than them. Because people would say it's Dembele. There was an argument over whether it was Edouard at one point. I was stuck with Dembele. Thank you. Now people are, would probably be fairly kind of consistent in saying that it's Kyogo.
Yeah.
But he's not as good as Larsson. So someday will come along and they might be better than Kyogo, but they would still be some way short. So I suppose the shadow will cast for a long time until somebody's really good and better than Henrik Larsson. Or everybody just gets that old that, you know, they forget about it because Henrik Larsson probably wasn't as good as Jimmy McGrory. But nobody really talks about that now because of how long ago it was.
2005, Larsson was gone. Is that right?
2004.
So you get a generation of fans that he is a memory, which is quite scary. You don't think you're talking about. That's quite concerning. I am now one of those people. It's like, I'll never be as good as Henrik.
Yes, Alan has been faced with the passage of time.
And I do not like it.
Yes, indeed.
Alan, you want to pick?
Go on, you do it.
You pick some. My first pick here.
Oh, good. Lee Naylor.
Drum roll. Oh, for fuck's sake. I don't want to pick. I'd like to just veto this and just pick again.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Get rid of that. Why would you put that in? Go on.
We're not even going to mention what it is.
This has worked out really well for
me. Because I think everyone's having a nice time.
We're enjoying ourselves. It's international break.
Chris Bowd, Red Wine Pod.
Chris Sutton.
There we go.
That's an improvement. I like Chris Sutton. It'll shock you to find. I like him a lot. I loved him as a player. I really liked his celebration. The right hook. I thought he was great. I even liked his attitude as a player at the time. I love some of the stories that youth players tell about him in the changing room because that is just a part of football. And I don't know if it is a part of football anymore, but it's a part of football that you love.
Yeah. It seems a sort of right time for it as well, in that type of dressing room. And
big character. People would probably call it bullying, I would imagine, in a way.
In reality.
Character building is how I would term it.
Go on, say the line.
No, I'm not saying the line. I loved Chris Sutton. I thought he was great as a player. I think a lot of people now, similar to that conversation about Henrik, will actually remember Chris Sutton as a pundit rather than a player, but don't be fooled. He was incredible. What I liked about Sutton was he played centre-half, centre-mid and centre-forward for us, and he was really, really competent throughout them all. Maybe a bit of a feeling that we had to do that with him, but he was a great player, great intelligence, and I know he won, obviously, the Premier League in 95. A lot of people would say that would be the height of his career, and, you know, that's a fair shout. The most successful and kind of the longevity of his career was at Celtic. He was really, really good here for a really long period of time. So I love him, and I quite like him as a pundit. I think he's fairly fair. What I like is dissimilar to his former strike partner, John Hartson, who I also love, but I think Chris Sutton doesn't hesitate if he sees something at Celtic that he doesn't think's right or doesn't think's up to the standards that he would have expected when he was there. I think he'll call it out, and what he did it with Ronnie Dyla, a lot of people thought it was harsh, but that's kind of similar to a lot of kind of people's thoughts on Ronnie, in that he was a nice guy, just not qualified or probably not the person that Celtic needed, and I think that was proved in the years that he left. So, yeah, I like Sutton, I like him a lot. You're not always going to agree with him, but it's not about an echo chamber. It's about, you know, good discussion, good chat. So, no, I love him. I think he's great, great memories.
Chris Sutton was a phenomenal football player. Now, I think everybody would agree that Larsson was world class. And, you know, maybe at the time when he was with us, so let's say maybe the English press wouldn't have said that, but I think what he'd done after he left us proved that.
Cemented that, yeah.
The term I'm saying that, but the term world class is a wee bit, what does it really mean anyway? But when you're talking about Chris Sutton, I wouldn't say he was world class, right? But he was part of two partnerships with Shearer and with Larsson, and he was intrinsic to their success as well, because he was a really clever player. He wasn't just a big target man, you know, he could fulfil that role, he could bring the ball in, hold it up, bring them into play as well. But he was really clever. I mean, his goal in the whitewash game where he chipped Kloss. Oh, that's not just a big target man, you know. And the fact you've already talked about that he could play at centre half and he could play in midfield, you know. He got one England cap, but that was down to him spitting the dummy after refusing to play for the B team. And the fact that he went to Chelsea, that's the reason why we got him, but it was almost like, oh, you know, big transfer flop, Chris Sutton, you know. There's millions of players that have done that and it's not worked out for them at a club. And we were really lucky that that happened, you know, to get him. And it was a lot of money at the time, you know. I mean, how much would 6 million be today? We would probably be talking about a record signing, if you will, which he was at the time, I think. But that, we were so lucky to get him because he was... He was so kind of key to that team. And just kind of on that point, what you said about John Hartson and really liking him. Hartson's a guy that I never liked as much as the majority of Celtic fans. And that's not for him. But it was because we, at times, accommodated Chris Sutton in midfield. Now, Chris Sutton could play in midfield, but Chris Sutton was, you know, and he was better at centre-half than he was at midfield.
Yeah.
But as a forward, I think that we weakened that front line, even though Larson was really good, by accommodating Sutton in midfield. That annoyed me. And at the time, I also remember thinking, I always thought we were a creative midfield, you know, and... Instead, I'm saying, well, why is Chris Sutton there when, you know, we're crying out for a player of that ilk? And why are we accommodating John Hartson? And that's probably not fair in Hartson because he scored loads of goals for us. Even after that era, you know, I remember being on a pod and talking about how many goals he scored for Strachan. His goal-scoring record was second to none. But I don't have anywhere near the love for him that I think a lot of people would do. And the main reason for that is I think that we maybe didn't utilise Chris Sutton as much with Larson when he came to the club.
I think that's an interesting point because, as you say, it's hard to sort of look at it because we did have the success and obviously Hartson played a big part in getting us to Seville, but I often think that if we had seen more of that, because if you think the 6-2 game that you mentioned and all the sort of success that we had with those two strikers, if we'd maybe spent the Hartson money, and that's doing him a big disservice because of the amount of goals he scored, but if we had... maybe bought a number 10 to replace Lobo. Who knows where we would have gone. But yeah, Chris Sutton for me, brilliant striker. I think he's possibly underrated by some. I think in terms of a footballer.
Yeah.
I think the goal that you mentioned, but I also always think of the volley against Juventus. I think that was probably one of his finest performances for us. I think the bigger the opposition, the more he sort of revelled in it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, Alan, about his sort of banter behind the scenes, excuse me, is when everyone always says, see, before big games in the dressing room, he'd say, we're going to get pumped today. Like, he's like, I think we're going to get beat 5-0. And that was just his way of sort of kind of having a bit of a laugh with the team. And then we would have gone out and beat the other team 5-0. But yeah, a fantastic foil for Larson. And as a pundit, I think everyone's probably seen the clip that's been doing the rounds on social media this week where he is sticking up for the Scottish game and just sort of kind of fighting off the English media who are saying, oh, another embarrassment for Celtic in Europe. And he lists the money that English teams have spent and also suffered heavy defeats as well.
And that's a key point because Sutton, as a pundit, a lot of folk don't like him. And there's no doubt he knows what he's doing sometimes in terms of winding folk up, you know. Did it with Craig and he's doing it with Chris Boyd just now and at other times. And there's many things where you could read about it and then time it to the second when Chris Sutton's going to tweet about it. You know, he did it at the weekend there with the five live dive of the week or something like that, you know, with the Rangers.
Almost game. Like 30 seconds after it, wasn't it?
But he's also a very intelligent pundit. He makes, you know, he makes incisive and proper points. And you hit the nail on the head. He sticks up for the Scottish game. There's no need for him to stick up for the Scottish game because he's not only a Scottish football pundit, he's an English football pundit too. He's on radio, he's on BBC Five Live. He could very easily be dismissive of it, but he doesn't. And I think that's something that a lot of Scottish kind of media don't do.
That's right.
And it's almost kind of, it's refreshing to hear because it's you know, listing that, you know, where people, that's all you need to do. You just need to kind of go through the points about the kind of financial difference between it. So, Chris Sutton, I salute you.
Probably. So, man,
I'm sure he's buzzing about that. Ha ha. Yeah, lads.
Lovely. Very nice.
The Lisbon Lions. Do you want me to say stuff about the Lisbon Lions?
That'd be lovely.
Don't really remember them. We'll talk about a shadow of Henrik Larsson, but the ultimate shadow is, you know, that team, yeah, the manager, every single player, you know, in not all positions, but in most of those positions, we'll have had better individual players in those positions, you know. But as a collective and as, you know, the foundation of what Celtic Football Club is, they'll never be beaten. They'll never be surpassed. See, if we won the Champions League, it still wouldn't matter, because the story of Lisbon and the story of what they've done has a, you know, romantic element to it. You know, the 30 miles of Celtic Park, all Scottish, that won't be repeated. First Northern European team, you know, attacking swashbuckling football, beating, you know, Inter's Catenaccio, who, I mean, Inter had won the European Cup a few times before that. You even hear them talking about it, where, you know, they look like film stars and they start singing the Celtic song. It was decades before we were born, but you're soaked in it. You know everything about it. You can rhyme the players off. You can everything. So, yes. I wish I was there.
Alan?
No, I think one of the things just is every fan will love successful, you know, teams from their own past. But Lisbon Lions kind of transcend that to an extent, because there is just a respect and reverence for them around the kind of footballing world. And I think as time passes, I think we're all guilty of it. I know I am. You sometimes find that clubs harking back to previous successes can almost be a bit twee, and you start to feel almost a wee bit embarrassed by it. Don't think that would a Lisbon Lions ever come into it, just because what they did, for the reasons that is listed there, it genuinely felt like a watershed moment in European football, because of what it did, what it showed you could do. And I just love that, and the fact that it was, you know, 11 Scottish players, and they played the most incredible type of football, even the way in which they won the game, the fact that it was kind of, you know, it was adversity. Yeah. And it's incredible. Like, there isn't a story about someone going there, or, you know, some bus trying to make it across, that I won't read, or one a newspaper article from any language that I wouldn't stop and think, I want to know what that said, because it's great. Remember, maybe like a year or two ago, there's footage online and there's video from, it's just tiny wee clips, but I think it's the 25th anniversary dinner that they had, and I think it was actually it's a Double Tree by Hilton now, and it's on Cambridge Street. I think then it was a Thistle Hotels.
Oh, yeah.
And even the 20, so that would have been what, 92? Even the 25th anniversary dinner just looks so low key, because it's just in a pretty basic hotel in town, and it's just, they have this dinner, like, and it's just the players, they probably, you know, sitting smoking at the table, and it's just incredible. And the fact that they had guys who, as a generational thing, I think, among people for the west of Scotland, having people that can tell stories, like, you could give me every single one of Bertie Old's stories and I could tell you them, and you would think, oh, they're quite funny, but see, when you hear Bertie Old tell one of the stories, he's just got a delivery and a way of doing it that just is so engaging. So it's great, and they're incredible. I think the club actually now do a lot in terms of, I think, the way we kind of remember it and commemorate it, it's really, really good. Obviously, the fans do it, big European nights as well. I think for a long time that wasn't the case, and they kind of were left to their own. But nowadays, it's great. You could go anywhere in the world wearing a green and white top and somebody will probably say, yeah, Lisbon Lions. And I think it's just incredible, considering that's what, how long ago it was.
Yeah, and I think to totally echo what you both said, but the fact that they are remembered, if you think every game, as you say, Alan, with the lights in the 67th minute, and then the recent song to the Argentina World Cup one. And yeah, it's one thing that whenever you see an article or whenever you see clips, you stop and watch it. I loved, there was a documentary for the 50th anniversary, and it was about the guy who's actually my old next door neighbour, the guy who was supposed to be getting married, and then they postponed the wedding to go.
Oh yeah,
to go, and it's him and his pal talking. I just love the stories like that. All the guy with the t-shirt saying Celtic okay and all that, and just running on the pitch. And every so often a picture will come up on Twitter that you haven't seen before. Very rare. But it's just mesmerising, the colour, the stadium. I've never actually done the pilgrimage to Lisbon, to the stadium. Any of you guys? Maybe that's something we should look into.
Dad, my brother did it a couple of years ago, and I think it was actually around about the time of the 50th anniversary, because they had a thing in the Hydro. Actually, I went to it, and it was the first time, it's the first non-match day time when the area around like the Hydro, Finiston, where everybody was just decked out in Celtic gear. Like, I remember sitting in a pub called, the pub is called Strip Joint. I was in Strip Joint.
Food's good then.
And I was, obviously the top for that year was just incredible. Oh. Genuinely one of the best Celtic tops, probably the best in my lifetime. And it was quite novel because it was scorching.
It was unbelievable.
Like, the weather was absolutely blazing. And it was nice just sitting in, and everybody around was clearly going to the gig. Everybody had like old retro tops on and stuff, and just sitting around having a beer. It was great. Like, see, it was probably the first time, like, as I say, non-match day, where it kind of was, obviously Celtic were extremely successful at the time, where you could actually just go out, and it was kind of like Celtic was, you know, Glasgow was green and white. Like, there was no getting by it, and it was great.
Well, the Finiston area certainly was.
Certainly was. I think Rangers' lack of success around that time as well meant you didn't see many of the, I know this was pre-Kiss story, but you know, occasionally you started to see them seep back when things get a wee bit brighter. None of that at the time.
Yeah, that's great. True. Yeah. And as we've all said, it's, I don't think they'll ever be beaten, and yeah, it's important that we celebrate them as much as we can.
Just, I suppose the last point on that is, you'd said it seemed like a watershed in kind of European football. I mean, between, you know, since the inception of the European Cup to the modern day, you know, however many European Cup finals that is, 60 odds or whatever, you know, there's key ones. There's, you know, Real Madrid, 7-9 track, Frankfurt, what, 3, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At Hampden. AC Milan beating Barcelona 4-0, you know, the total kind of dominating performance and things like that. There's a lot of them that, you know, I was doing it the other day with my boys, naming everybody that's won the Champions League. It's actually quite easy. But if you're then spreading that out to finals, there's so many non-events, you know, whereas that isn't, that there's more to it. See, if you're not a Celtic fan, it's still a story.
It still stands out,
you know. Everybody knows about, you know, 7-3 with the Eintracht, you know, that's one of those finals that you would kind of put down, you know, along with some of the other ones that I've mentioned. So it's more than just Celtic, and that's why, you know, as the years go by, it might become a bit twee, or you might think, God, it was so long ago, but it's still a footnote in history for football as well as for Celtic.
And I think even if you just look at the shots on goal, it's like incredible. I don't think I've seen it's, is it not like in the 40s or something like that for Celtic, something as high as that?
Yeah.
And it was just wave after wave of attack.
Tell you what I really would like to know, the XG.
I think the XG machine would blow up.
It's not about the volume of shots, it's about the quality of the shots, I believe.
And there was a few from outside the box.
Yeah, I fucking smacked round the ear if you said that.
Right, we'll do one more.
Don't think you can beat Lisbon, can you?
Aye, that'll do it.
Aye, that's a nice way to round it off. So hopefully you've enjoyed it. We certainly have. There's a few that we've maybe questioned that, again, we won't mention on air, and we'll have words with the our gallant leader and why that was ever there.
We'll take it up at SFA on Monday.
That's it. But no, I've enjoyed it, Samani. Thank you for your participation.
Sorry, half interrupted you. You're there. It's been great. Cheers.
Yeah, and we'll come back to you at some point on your first game against Rangers.
I'll think about it.
In the Glasgow Derby. Wink, wink. Alan?
Pleasure. Good way to break up the international week. So thank you very much, boys.
Well, we'll just end it there. So I've been Barry Gallagher. Thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you down the road.